Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to another edition of our program, Dare to Be Different. Just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, and we've really, really fortunate. We've had brilliant weather for the last couple of days, and for that we are truly blessed. And talking about, the weather, we find that, talking to someone last week, he said, you know, summer has never really left us, and I was wondering about it. And he said, you know, we haven't had the cold snap that we anticipated, we haven't had the black frost as well. And looking back in many gardens, we find that that is a reality. Things are still in bloom. If you look at the fuchsias in some gardens, they still haven't died down. In other people's gardens, you find that even the basil is still growing. So has summer really left us? I doubt that very much. And speaking to people in different programs that we've had over the last couple of weeks, people are saying that we still may have one cold snap coming up, and I'm not too sure about that. But wherever you are, whether you are listening to us on the DSTV 826, Satellite Islam, Medium Wave 1548, please join our conversation. Number to dial this morning, 18-854-1548, and Mohammed waiting to take your calls. We've got a wonderful, wonderful guest, and that's Andrea. Andrea Durham, she comes in from the Southern Cape, beautiful area. She can help us along with some of the issues, and if you have any queries, any questions, remember to call in as well. Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, good morning. How are you this morning?
Very well, thank you. I know you're raring to go. Spring is in the air. Is that true? Can we really say true? Spring is here.
You can really feel the spring arriving. You know, we as human beings, we love to put things in boxes. We love to say, you know, spring starts on a certain date or something like that. But plants live differently. They don't boxify nature. And what they usually do is when the days start getting longer, they definitely are. And, you know, down here in the Western Cape, we specifically feel the changes of day length being so fast up. And we're seeing the sun coming up later and later every morning. We're getting more sunshine. So, yeah, the plants react to that, and they go, it's springtime.
You know, whilst we're saying it's springtime, other people are saying, well, we're still in for another cold snap, and weather predictions are that there may be cold and snow on your part of the world. Would that be a reality?
Very much so. You know, the spring is known, I think, around the world as a treacherous season when it comes to the weather. It's betwixt and between. It's neither one nor the other. It's not summer. It's not winter. And, of course, here in the Western Cape, we get the late snow on the mountains. And that snow on the mountains will affect, I mean, it's basically all the mountains of this escarpment that basically get covered in snow at certain times. And it's usually here in August and sometimes September. And I've even seen it happen as late as November. And when that happens, of course, the whole country gets cold.
So when we're talking about that, you know, people say, good indicator. I know my late dad would say 15th of September, that's when you start. When I had a guest on, someone last week said 9th of September. And others say, well, 1st of September is spring day. Yay, here we go. Which one would you go with?
I would say that you really can't, you can't actually put any particular date on it. Because, you know, we have so many different climatic conditions in this country. It's a big country. And you will know the area. When you're a gardener, you actually have to become very in touch with the seasons, very in touch with nature, very in touch with what's happening in your little space, because you also have microclimates that are different. So, you know, some people will find that they've already had their last frost. I think they will probably still be cold snaps, but you get used to the pattern of the seasons and you start to know, well, you know, the last frost is usually. And, you know, a lot of people keep gardening diaries, just, you know, keeping track of things like that. You know, was it frosty this morning? When did I sow my seeds? When did I harvest them? When did things come into flower and so on? And this can really, really inform your next year and give you much better success when it comes down to that. But, you know, the weather is, it doesn't always play along with what we think it ought to do. Like I say, the latest I've ever seen the snow on the mountains thing was November. And I mean, normally November you think, well, I'm already in summer just about. So the weather doesn't always do what we think it ought to.
You know, I must say to you that nature is a very good indicator. If you look at some of your plants, and I'm talking about specific particularly, you know, in our area, we find that the jasmines, when you're walking around, you find this in full bloom already, talking about star jasmines, and that's an indication. Last week it was budding, you saw the, you know, the red, and now suddenly you find it's bloom and blossoming, and all the whites have come out. So for me, that's the first indicator. And then you look outside and you find that the peach trees have, you know, come into bloom, and that's another indicator. So you can't really go by dates, you know, you've got to go by weather, and weather does give you an indication of that the seasons are changing. And we haven't had, you know, weather dipping or the season where it dips below one, and I think that was a big concern because we still have a lot of hohos and aphids around.
Yes, well, the tool does definitely help to control pests. Of course, where I live, that is less of a contributor. But for example, in Europe, where we used to do a lot of plant exporting. So now, when you export plants, you have to make sure that there are no insects on them, no plant diseases or anything like that that you're exporting. And different countries have rules of varying strictness. Australia is the strictest because there are a lot of pathogens and insects on that we have that they don't have. And it's almost impossible. The United States is quite difficult because they've got all those climate zones. They've also got the warm areas in Florida and so on. Europe is actually one of the easiest. Reason being, cold winters. So even if something slips through, which unfortunately can happen, I mean, there have been worldwide plant plagues, such as the phylloxera epidemic would perhaps be the most famous one that killed almost all the grapes in France at one time in history. And this has all happened to us as human beings, moving plants around and bringing new things into spaces. Now, in Europe, it just gets so cold, it wipes those things out to a large degree. So depending on where it's going in Europe, obviously the warmer areas, Mediterranean areas, is a bit more difficult. But the colder areas, they're not too worried.
No, definitely. So when we're looking at, you know, what is happening in our own climate and, around us, we find lots of people have now gone into, you know, rigorous pruning process, and you find that trees are being pruned and so forth. Would there be a concern if we have a cold snap and they're busy pruning?
You know, the thing with pruning is that it does rejuvenate and it does stimulate growth. But directly after pruning, you would invariably find that there's very, very soft growth coming out, soft young new growth. And that is not yet very strong. So if there's a cold snap, it will frost again. And it won't necessarily kill the plant, but it will weaken the plant. However, plants do have reserves. If you're pruning, for example, your ornamentals, your garden ornamentals and so on, I think you also need to look at how frost hardy they are. Do they usually tend to frost when it's cold? Some of them can really, really handle it. They can take temperatures below zero, and even the soft growth is fine. Other plants, again, would be more tender. And you as a gardener, you've been working with these plants for a couple of years by now, so you know. And certainly anything that's frosted back already, you can know, well, that's something that when you prune it, it's now going to be vulnerable because it's actually been protected to a certain extent by these frosted leaves on the top of the plant. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's like where a plant, basically the top frosts down, but then the bottom's still nice and alive. Now that top is actually protecting that bottom. Now, theoretically, when the spring comes around, you prune it, and the plant goes hippie, and it grows out again, and it's beautiful. But if there is a late frost, it will pinch it back again. And how well it survives that, how well it comes back after that, will largely depend on the reserves which the plant has managed to store up for itself.
I think that's so true, because when you look at some plants, you find they're more resilient and will be able to come back, you know, and you find that whilst the tops may have burnt or, you know, have died back, yet a couple of weeks later you find they're coming and they bounce back, and you find that this is, you know, the plant that I thought wasn't going to survive.
Yes, plants are very individual. If you would like to check the frost hardiness of your plant, there's actually a very, very nice little cheat that you can do to find out. You will find a lot of variation. But again, it's because plants just don't always do what we expect them to do. Nature doesn't always do what we expect them to do. But what I do when I want to check frost hardiness, I go online. And there's such a thing called the USDA hardiness zone. And this is a thing that was drawn up quite long ago, and continually growing. It's a growing knowledge base. It started out basically being the United States Department of Agriculture's plant cold hardiness zone. According to, because I mean, it's such a big country, they've got so many different latitudes in there. They've got everything from tropical to really icy cold. So they wanted to be able to help initially farmers to be able to time their crops and schedule their crops according to where they are. So they started off these hardiness zones, which represent temperature ranges by latitude. And they can now be summed up as the lowest temperature and the highest temperature that a plant will take, and how normally the lowest temperature being the main limiting factor. So you've got USDA zones 1, 2, I think it's 9, 9 being quite tropical and 1 then being very chilly. And there are temperature zones, temperature ranges for each of these zones. Now, as gardeners have been experimenting and so on with plants and growers, they have been adding to this by busy classifying certain plants according to their USDA hardiness zone. So they're basically saying, if you're in the United States and you're reading a national gardening magazine, what you do and how suitable the plants are going to be for you or whatever is going to largely depend on the temperature ranges that you're in. So what you do is you go on the internet, you type in a plant name, and you prefix that search with USDA hardiness zone. And like I say, you're going to find differing results. I might like to play it safe. Some guys are going to maybe say, oh, this will handle USDA zone 3, which I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think tolerates up to about minus 10 degrees. And then you'll find the next guy to be saying, no, but it actually fits into a much warmer hardiness zone. So I always sort of tend to bias towards the guy who says the warmer one. Because, yes, there are degrees of survival. Something can frost back all the way to the ground and yet still survive. Maybe that's not quite what you want from your plant. But you can really research this, and a lot of the garden ornamentals and even our indigenous plants have been classified by various growers and so on according to these temperature ranges. Because you get plants that can tolerate easily temperatures, you know, sort of below minus 10 even. It just depends on what's in that plant, how the sap freezes, how the cells are made up and so on. I mean, you get these evergreen conifers that grow in the snow, and they don't drop their leaves or burn or anything when it's cold. So it's very species specific. It's not a magical plant. You'll never know everything.
Yes, I think that's an important indicator. And so if you go, you look for the USDA, you know, indicator, and then you put it in there, whatever it is, and it gives you zone 3 or zone 5, whatever the case may be, will then tell you the hardiness of that particular plant. Is that correct?
That's correct, and it will give you a temperature zone. So a temperature range. So what I usually do is I Google the USDA USDA plant hardiness zone map. Is a map, and it gives all the information of what those zones consist of. Then in a separate window, I will Google that plant and look at what different growers are saying, decide which one I'm going to trust, and then I'll go back to that map and look at the temperature range that implies. Because it has been designed to a large degree for Americans. They know which zone they're in. So it doesn't always specify. It will just say USDA zone 7. What does that mean? So you go back to the map, and then you check the temperature range, and then you can get a very, very good idea of how cold hardy that plant is. And that does mean, though, you need to know the plant name. So if you don't know the plant name, then you take a PC, and you run down to your local garden center, and you say, please, guys, do you know what this is?
I must say thank you very much, because when I looked at it, I was wondering what these zones stand for, and I couldn't understand, you know, how it's going to impact on us. But now that I have a clear understanding that the USDA would then tell you the tolerance of the plant in a particular zone, and that is definitely useful. And if anyone wants to, I think it's quite an easy search to do. Get onto the computer, USDA, get the name of the plant, and you'll be able to see the tolerance level of that particular plant with regards to the coldness in a particular area. Now, I must say to you that, you know, over the last couple of weeks, I've been, you know, following some articles and magazines and so forth, and everyone is talking about mulch. Just everyone is talking about mulch, and I looked at yesterday in the paper as well, K. Montgomery speaks about mulch as well, and they talk about the different types of mulch. Now, we've been talking about mulch, you know, quite often on this particular program, and people still don't understand the value of mulch. Can you just unpack some of that for us?
Oh, that is such a huge topic. Mulch is nature's way. I mean, if you think of a piece of ground that has been more or less undisturbed, nobody's gardened it, whatever, plants have been growing there for thousands of years. They've been going through their life cycle, and they've been leaving their bodies on the ground, gradually breaking down into humus, which is wonderful for the soil. Soil is actually, it almost, I like to say soil is almost alive. There's so much going on in there. There are beneficial organisms. There are also pathogens sometimes and problems. But very often beneficial organisms that are working together in a system with certain requirements. And that system has to be fed. And the food that it gets from that system is the organic matter. And then also bear in mind that moss changes, it changes the temperature range of the soil. So it's actually like a little blanket. When it's hot, it helps to keep the soil a little bit cool so it doesn't get so baking hot that roots can burn. And that can happen. I've seen it happen. So it shades that up. If it's cold, it stops the soil from freezing because it's like a blanket on top. It's like a little blankie insulating the soil. And that can also, again, prevent frost damage, which happens when soil freezes, which fortunately in this country only really happens in the very, very cold areas. But it does happen in them. And so the mulch would help to protect that. The mulch acts as a habitat, if you will, for all these beneficial organisms that help your plants grow, that help nature take its course. Soil is a system. This is, we live in the air. Well, we stand on the soil and live in the air. There's so much, it's almost like a different world going on in soil. When I studied soil science, it used to absolutely amaze me. So mulch is nature's way of actually keeping that happening. But it also has a lot of benefits to us. Other than that, it helps you to reduce your watering frequency. Because again, it's acting like a little blanket on top of the soil, busy sheltering and protecting it. So you can save a lot of water by mulching. Really, really, really. And then, of course, it keeps weeds down. Because weeds are designed by nature to grow on disturbed soil. Now, disturbed soil has certain natural characteristics. For example, you will get these highly fluctuating soil temperatures that I was talking about. The soil getting very hot in some cases, or the soil getting very cold in other cases. But particularly heat in this instance. These seeds of the weeds are triggered by these conditions. They go, yes, the soil is disturbed. I can sense the soil is disturbed because there's nothing protecting the soil. The temperatures are fluctuating. And I know I'm going to find a place as a pioneer plant to now grow. And that's what a weed is, a pioneer plant. That's a different another plant. So as soon as you put mulch on top, you're again limiting that temperature fluctuation. And the weeds just don't come up because the conditions aren't right. Some of them may try, but because they're now under a layer of mulch that they've got to grow through before they can do anything, there's a chance that they could die before they ever surface. And of course, you'll get the odd survivor. That's just how it goes. But you will have much, much fewer weeds coming up in your garden. So you're really cutting down on labor. You're cutting down on the resources that you have to bring into your garden. And over time, because mulch does break down, mulch, if you keep it on top of the soil, and especially if it's a relatively fresh material, not that well composted, it must remain on top of the soil because if you dig it in, it's going to start breaking down and it's going to take nitrogen away from your plant. But over time, over years, because you're going to keep refreshing your mulch as it breaks down, you're actually going to get a rich humus layer in your soil that develops there naturally because you've kept your mulch, your mulching up. So many benefits of mulch. I really recommend it.
Yes, and we look at it, we spoil for choices these days. You've got macadamia nut shells, you've got peach shells, pine bark. You know, that's attractive, so people doesn't have to look unsightly. And of course, then you've got what nature's given us, dry leaves, dry, cuttings. So we've got a lot of that that we could use. And then, of course, if you have, someone who works with wood, there's a lot of this, chips and so forth that you could use. Is that right?
Yes, but you do have to be a little bit cautious with certain types of mulch. Wood chips, for example, be very careful not to root them in, especially if they're relatively fresh. Chip shavings, bark, it normally gets fairly composted, but you'll be able to see how composted it is because it's black when it's composted. If it's still brown, which you do get, relatively fresh, fine bark at top, please don't work it into your soil. Several reasons, because wood contains tannin, and that's actually why it can actually make it very, very difficult for other plants to grow. They toxify the soil for them. And also because of this negative nitrogen period that I was telling you about, when you have fresh organic matter dug into soil, it immediately attracts bacteria and it starts taking nitrogen. They start taking nitrogen to grow and break down this thing. Nitrogen is very important plant food for your plant. So So it can actually impoverish your soil if you dig it in. So if you're using wood chips, things like that is not composted, any uncomposted material, some people don't even mind the grass clippings idea. They just want the practical benefits of mulch. Whatever you're using, if it's not composted, do not dig it in. What you do on top of the soil is very different to what you do under the soil.
So any mulch, you know, the rule of thumb would be just to layer it in the top and you don't dig it into your soil. Is that correct?
Correct. And you will see that over time it does tend to break down. That's because that stuff is composting. And then you can sort of give it a rake, take off maybe some of the top layer, because the top layer would usually be the last to compost. And then underneath you can have a look and see. You can even smell it. If it's giving it off a very strong tannin smell, it's sort of like, well, like smelling a cup of tea almost, then it's not ready to work with.
Thank you very much for that. And before we go for, you know, break, finally, we have lots of, ground covers that are living mulches. Tell us something about that.
Well, obviously that is nature's way at its very, very best. Yes, certainly ground covers do act as natural mulch. They have all the same benefits, moderating the temperature of the soil, reducing water usage by shading the soil, reducing those temperature fluctuations that encourage wheat seeds to grow and so on. The traditional Western idea is to have soil in between plants, and I really don't agree with that. I think it's time that we, as modern human beings, moved into a new era of gardening where we might cast away a lot of the traditional ideas. My grandmother, for example, always believed you had a plant and then you had an open space of soil and then you had another plant. And that's not really a good way to garden. Of course, if you aesthetically prefer it, fine, that's what mulch is for. But a living ground cover mulch is certainly a lovely, low maintenance way to protect your soil. And if there's natural cycles going on, leaves busy enriching the soil as their time of life goes on, a leaf doesn't last forever. And so all the benefits of mulch you really do get from a living mulch of ground covers.
Thank you very much. We're going to go for an ad break. When we come back, we'll continue. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yes, it's another additional program, Day to Be Different. Just wonderful to have all of you tuning in. And please remember, you could join our conversation at any time. The number to dial this morning is 854-1548. And we have Andrea Durham, who is sharing some wonderful information with us. And remember that you could call in at any time. Mohammed is waiting to take on your calls. Andrea, thank you very much for being with us. I've had a couple of questions coming through. The first one with regards to mulching. When you're putting mulch in, do you have to till or do you have to put in your fork into the ground? Yes, no?
No. That's the lovely thing. You know, no-till gardening and even no-till farming is becoming extremely popular because of the limitation of soil disturbance. And we've spoken before about how soil disturbance encourages weeds to grow. So you don't have to dig over it all. You just basically put that layer of mulch on top. Ta-da! Job done.
Okay, and generally the rule about no fork and no tilling, I know there's a trend. I was checking some of that coming through with some of the farmers that have gone in that particular route. Tell us about that.
Well, really, it's just a matter of limiting soil disturbance. There's several reasons for it. Soil is a system. It is absolutely amazing. Once you start studying it, one of the subjects you have to do when you become a horticulturist is soil science. And I don't know what it's like now, but you have to actually do it for a full year. And it's such an incredible field because there's just so much going on in soil. Now, any system that is disturbed is no longer in balance. And soil is in balance when it's natural and left on its own and not interfered with. So we try to foster that balance. We don't want to break up the structure of the soil too much. Breaking up the structure of the soil really, really affects our plants' growth. We also, again, weed seeds, as we mentioned, when you disturb soil, you tend to get more weeds coming up, and that is also an issue. So I would say that that would be the main reason. You want to keep that system in balance. It consists of so many things. Natural soil organisms that are living in the soil, the structure of the soil, the physical structure of the soil, and then, of course, also the other biological things that are in the soil, for example, weed seeds. So the less you disturb the soil, the better it gets on. The only exception I would say is most soils, unfortunately, are not in the ideal state of balance because they have been disturbed over the years. And then as a gardener, your task is to try and restore that balance. And one of the best ways to do that is compost. And compost, yes, you certainly dig in compost. And you work that in. You are actually addressing an imbalance. Also, of course, nature has different balances. There are some areas of the world and of the country where you do have extremely sandy soil, where you do have extremely clay soil, and that might make it extremely difficult for you to grow crops.
Got another question is coming through. It says, what is winter oil? It says mixed with sulfur to put on a peach tree.
What is that?
What is winter oil? It says mixed with sulfur and to put on a peach tree. It's from one of the listeners. I'm not sure what it means.
It might be an instruction on the product that they got. I can hazard a guess in that it could be oleum, which is a non-toxic insecticide that smothers insects. But I am not sure. I would suggest that the listener goes to wherever they got their lime sulfur and just have a chat to people about that. I'm really not an expert on fruit trees. Lime sulfur, definitely before they produce anything like a blossom or a leaf. And I would say that oleum would probably go well with that. But I would check that wherever you bought that.
Thank you very much for that one. And Andrea, we're now coming, where people are getting edgy and saying, but is it time for us to, plant and sow seeds? Is that correct?
Again, it really depends on what you're planting and where you live. With plants being so adaptable, so different, so endlessly diverse, you can actually garden in most parts of this country right around the year, just depending on what you're doing. Your garden centres, they're qualified horticulturists there. Of course, they don't know everything. Nobody knows everything. I make mistakes too, especially when it comes to fruit trees. they will be able to find the information if they don't know it of what is suitable to plant at any given time of the year. I love gardening at this time of the year because the weather is mild. And also the soil doesn't dry out too much too quickly. It helps you to establish your plants more easily in my part of the country because you don't have them drying out as much and we don't get harsh frost. But also if I were planting something that is frost tolerant and that has been grown strongly, hasn't been grown in a greenhouse, it's been grown outdoors, I would also be fairly confident about planting that out even in the coldest area.
Thank you very much. Let's take this call. There's a call coming through. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Please go ahead, Ben.
Ismail Bhai, I'd like to know, how does one encourage worms to grow in the garden?
You want to encourage worms in your garden. Okay,
yes.
Let's see if Andrea can help us with that. Are you going to stay online?
I'll listen on the air.
JazakAllah, thank you very much. Andrea, how do you encourage worms in a garden?
Well, I imagine that the lady is thinking about earthworms.
That's right, earthworms.
One of the best things that you can have in your garden, organic matter. So again, it's your composting. Composting is important to bring back these kind of soil fauna that are part of the natural balance of soil. And as you were saying earlier, sometimes in your area, there are less areas, less places where the soil is rich in organics. But a richly organic soil is generally good for almost any plant. I'm an indigenous person. I've been working with indigenous plants for over 12 years. And a lot of people think, indigenous plants, you don't need to compost the soil because South Africa does generally have poor soil. But organic matter is always beneficial to soil. When you have a poor drainage, it improves drainage. When you have poor water retention, it improves water retention. And it does also create a habitat for all the beneficial soil organisms, including those earthworms. So, and also, earthworms tend to like it, relatively moist. Average garden conditions will be fine for them, I think. And so, yes, you can definitely encourage earthworms in your garden. Some people take it to the next level, and they start little earthworm farms and whatnot. And I have seen kits available where you can actually grow earthworms and then collect the castings and the wormy juice and the whatever and use that in your garden. That, I would say, is really for enthusiasts. But just for the average person, the more organic matter you have in your soil, and then also, again, mulch. Mulch is wonderful. It also helps to moderate the temperatures there for them and so on. So that's your ideal. Organic matter, moisture, and a layer of mulch is the best way to keep that moisture in.
I'm not too sure, but I heard people who do fishing, normally buy worms, and maybe you could buy some of that from there. Would that be the same worms, Andrea?
Gosh, I don't go fishing.
Well, I'm not very sure as well about that, but I know people buy these worms. So
you get mealworms, I would guess.
Well, to the sister,
sometimes earthworms. Maybe they're earthworm farmers.
So what we are saying to the listener is that when you're wanting to is to encourage an environment where they can thrive, and that is to get them into a soil and to make sure their natural habitat is, you know, conducive so that these earthworms will be encouraged to breed in that. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's the case. Now, in every nursery that I've worked, wholesale nursery, you can imagine we've got hectares of plants in potting medium. Now, potting medium is highly organic. It's actually purely organic. There might sometimes be the occasional inorganic addition, but it's not soil. It's organic, mainly composted bark is the most common potting medium in this country. A lot of people are moving now to other things, but traditionally that's what we grew in. So we basically had a mass of organic matter. And what would happen is every time you pick up a pot or a bag or something, just about every time, you find an earthworm lying underneath it. And I mean, obviously we're not growing it on bare ground, we're growing it on beds that may have gravel put on top, or may have a layer of this black gum plastic put down to prevent the roots from rooting through. But you wouldn't imagine that being the most wonderful place for an earthworm. But because of the organic matter in the pots and so on, there were always earthworms under the pot. And then when we transplanted the plants, you know, kicked them out of the pot, put them into a bigger pot, you'd invariably find earthworms busy in that root ball. So it's really just a matter of organic. When you have the right environment, I think it will happen by itself.
Thank you very much for that. And, you know, is there anything else that we should be looking out at this particular time of the year with spring coming in and other chores to be done?
Well, flowers. The time has come to look for the beautiful, bright flowers. They are coming, specifically the Cape Flora, it being winter rain adapted. It's tending to be in flower, and a lot of these are ornamental plants that are growing throughout the country. So flowers, it's happening all around the country now. And of course, especially in the Cape wildflower area that is poised to be in flower very soon. So yes, I think we could start looking out for the joys of spring, and we could start looking out for birdies coming back, and we could start looking at the flowers appearing in our gardens. Interestingly, the birds are apparently coming back earlier than before. I was talking to an ornithologist the other day, and he records the migration of the birds, the dates when they leave and the dates when they come back. And he said that consistently over the last decade or so, they have been coming back earlier and earlier, which indicates to him that conditions are warmer.
Definitely with that, you know, Andre, you hear the chirping of birds very much early, and you hear them early in the morning, and they've definitely come in, you know, and looking around us and our garden. Yes, they're looking, lots of them are building their nest already, so it's, you know, it's an indication that many of the migratory birds are back in the area.
There are a lot of uplifting things right now at the moment. You were talking about the jasmine in flower, that scent of jasmine in the air. It's always been to me, you know, an uplifting experience. And I've always been happy when I smell it because I know spring's on the way. So, yes, the sights, the sounds, the smells, even new leaves starting to spring from deciduous trees and shrubs and so on. All those signs of spring are there. And we just have to see them to enjoy them, and sometimes be busy and we sort of walk around blinkered and tunnel visioned. So I think the time is to be very mindful of the beauties of the season that are creeping in, the change of the season.
I'm looking at an article from the Western Cape. It says spring has sprung and our beautiful province has started to shake off the winter chills and dressing itself in fields of colorful flowers. And that's one of the most, you know, one of the wonders of nature. And we look in places like Paternoster and further, you know, field into different nature parks. We find that there's a magnificent display. Have you seen some of that, Andrea? Have you gone out to witness that?
People come from all over the world to see this beautiful, beautiful sight. I think we South Africans should make a point of going. Why miss it? It's so close, it's on our doorstep. And yet people from the world, all over the world, are coming, you know, thousands of kilometers to come and see this beautiful, beautiful sight of the Cape wildflowers in bloom. And of course, even the non-traditional areas, you know, even, you know, the Klein Karoo and places like that are bursting into bloom. So yes, there's beauties of nature to be seen at this time of year.
And have you witnessed that, Andrea?
Oh, yes.
And is it as stunning as they make it out to be?
It depends on when you catch it, unfortunately. It's very difficult to time it because it's nature and you can't give it a date. So the only thing you can really do is go when it's usually at its best and hope that you see it in full, full. I don't think I saw it in full bloom, but I'm sure everyone's seen and heard of this absolute carpet of gorgeous, gorgeous flowers that's happening. I think I came towards the tail end when I went through that area. It was still amazing. It was still absolutely amazing, but people told me it was not at its peak at the time.
Question coming through. I've got lots of fuchsias in my garden. It hasn't died down. Is it time for me to prune, or should I just leave them for the next season, for the coming season?
It's a tricky one again because of the so many different climate zones in this country. I'm not sure where the listener is located. If she is in a very cold area, I would suggest maybe leaving them alone. In my area, certainly, my fuchsias never die down, so I just prune them whenever they get a bit blanky or leggy. But if it's a very cold area, she might not want to encourage soft growth right now.
And would they become straggly if they're not pruned? I think that's the next question.
I beg your pardon?
Would they become very straggly if they're not pruned? You know, would they have enough growth if they're not, you know, would they be strong enough to withstand the next or the coming season?
Well, you know, you can prune fuchsias quite hard. You know, I would say look at your weather. If you're not a person experiences very hard frost, I would prune now because they will tolerate even a light frost. Fuchsias need to be cut to keep them bushy, if that's what you want. They're lovely in that you can manipulate them, you can turn them into standards, get one shoot to grow all the way up and then make a bubble on the top. But most often people tend to get them in a shrub and want them to have as many shoots as possible. And for that, you actually even want to do some pinching of the green growth during the growing season as well. When I used to grow fuchsias commercially, we would start the cutting, and we would pinch and pinch and pinch and pinch every time it made a couple of inches of growth to get a really nice structure. And then once we had that really nice structure, we felt this is now ready for a gardener to take because it's got a lot of foundation branches and a lot of shoots coming off of those foundation branches. The fuchsias, the art of them is really cut, and even pinch the green growth. Maybe as a compromise, if you're worried about frost, you could even just pinch back to leaves. But like I said, they actually tolerate quite hard cutting. I've seen them be touched, you know, with absolutely nothing, and they come back again. So it pretty much depends on the circumstances.
Question coming through. I live in Gauteng, and you know, night temperatures haven't gone below 6 degrees. Is that a good indication of it's time for us to plant?
Expect a late cold snap to be on the safe side. Also do be aware though of your microclimates in your garden. You'll have areas of your garden where the frost tends to settle very heavily, and you also have areas of your garden that hardly ever get frost. So your intimate knowledge of your environment around your home is also very important to deciding when it's spring. But I would expect a late cold snap.
Andrea, someone inquiring about the weather out in the Western Cape. Has the drought been broken?
No, I don't believe so at all. I think this has basically been a cumulative a lack of rainfall for years. Yes, you know, we get a lovely rain and it soaks the ground. We had a lovely one last night. And then people go, wow, you know, the drought's been broken because of rain. No, unfortunately, we need a lot of rain. We need a lot of rain. George Dam at the moment standing at 40%. Water restrictions in place there. That's my nearest city. I know Knysna's been water stressed for a long time. The bush here, the enormous bushfires that we've had, were fostered by the amount of drought that we've been had over a period of years. We have even seen the indigenous vegetation, which is adapted to the climate here, really struggling, tending to die back. A lot of dead wood in the bush and so on. Always an indication of years of drought, really. Seeing things coming back after the recent rains, things that dropped their leaves due to leaf economy, deciding, well, I'm going to throw off my green growth because I can't support it, and then just hanging in there and waiting. And those things are starting to sprout back in nature. But I would by no means say that the drought is over. No, I think we need to be very, very careful with water. And I think as we realize the population is growing, cities are growing, there's increasing pressure on the water resources, many times from outdated systems. For example, the George Dam is quite a small dam, and there has been talk back and forth about finding ways to increase the water storage capacity for the city, because the city is growing. There are people moving in here all the time. I think this is pretty much a situation with all the cities in the country, where we basically haven't had upgrades to water storage. So the water is there's more pressure on it, even when there is a relatively good amount of rain. And then we have then also had lack of rain or low rain for over a period of years, cumulative. There's somebody in my neighborhood, very sustainable person, they've got rainwater tanks, thousands and thousands of liters built in under their house. And for the first time in decades, those rainwater tanks are empty, completely empty. That's a micro example of what has been happening, because over the years that we've been getting lower rainfall than we expect. So we really need to be careful. Water is very precious.
And when does your water, you know, your water season come to an end? You know, you have a different climatic zone than we have in our side, so it's a winter rainfall. When does it come to an end, traditionally?
Well, it also again depends where in the Western Cape you are. Where I am, I'm sort of on the cusp between the winter and summer rainfall areas, and we're looking at our heaviest rain here in August, September, usually. In more towards Cape Town area, I think they get it a bit earlier, and it ends a little bit earlier as well. But yeah, the super, super rainy time I'm really, really hoping for is upon us in this part of the world, certainly.
Thank you very much, and we've got a fantastic initiative coming up, and that's called the Sunflower Fund, and that's money that's being donated to the foundation for diseases like cancer, leukemia, and so forth. Tell us something about this particular initiative, and how could our gardeners assist?
Well, you're going to be planting and gardening a lot now anyway. It is time to start thinking spring. I've put in a few disclaimers because nature can sometimes upset us. But it's time to be thinking spring. It's time to be giving out to your garden centers. Now, in South Africa, we have a Growers Association and a Garden Center Association, which falls under a body called the South African Nursery Association, the public face of which is Life is a Garden, which, by the way, I encourage listeners, go there, go visit their website. They've got what you need to do in the garden per month, per area of the country. It's all there. Lovely website that they've got. They've got a Facebook page. You can put your gardening questions there and so on. But this is more than just an initiative to market gardening. It also tries to give back. And every year, and quite often around about this time, they'll have an initiative. And what happens is that the growers and the retailers get together, and they decide on certain plants that are going to be beautiful, absolutely stunning at this time of the year, and they pledge to donate an amount of money. Per plant that is sold, both the grower and the retailer will then donate for each plant that is sold to a central fund, which then goes to this charity initiative. And the way you can identify the plant is it will usually be some sort of a mark on it. In this case, it's going to be a sunflower. So what the end result for the consumer is, they don't pay more for the plant. They pay exact same price they would have paid if this initiative had not been running. It's not an amount of money that's tacked on top of the price. What is happening is that the gardening industry, the green industry in South Africa, has pledged an amount of money for you buying that plant. So you're not paying more. You're buying the plant, same plant price. You're going out and you're gardening just as you would have gardened anyway. But you have pleasure and satisfaction of knowing that the result of you buying a plant with a sunflower sticker on it means that the green industry in South Africa is going to donate money to charity. Now, the organization usually lays down a guideline around how much money that should be. But quite often, the growers and the retailers go over and above that because they feel it's a worthy cause. So that is an individual choice for them. But there will certainly be the minimum amount that's donated for each plant that is sold. And this year's the Sunflower Initiative. It's for the bone marrow bank. And that's for people with bone cancer and leukemia. So you can help somebody who's suffering, who's ill, by making your garden a more beautiful place. And every time you look at that plant, you can say to yourself, I did something good by buying this plant.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. Unfortunately, we'll have to leave it at that. And thanks for being with us on this program. We'll chat to you again sometime in the future. Thanks, Milan.
I'll look forward to it.
Thanks, Tab. Bye-bye. And there's Andrew Durham. They're talking to us about what is to be done at a particular time of the year and lots of other information. And don't forget the Sunflower Fund. It's all from me. Until we meet again, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.